Sometimes I wonder if the moment of silence that we have each week is not the most important practice that we engage in. Especially when so much of life is like a deluge of information and experiences and emails and lights and buzzing, and yeah, it's not unless you're making it a regular part of your day, which maybe is something we should all think about. How often do you sit together with other people and do nothing for 1 minute except just be present? And silence is a kind of, I was going to say something that sounds contradictory. There's a roaring absence of silence in our culture. And when we hear bad news, and I want to talk about some bad news today, what immediately happens is a lot of expertise. And I'm thinking, again, of the school shooting in Detroit. And I want to say a few things about it. And I don't want to say a few things about it. And so many people are saying many things about it. And it hurts, I'm sure, as you feel the pain of even having to look at something like this or hear about it. It hurts as a parent. I have two teenagers. Actually, one just turned 20, so I have one teenager, to be technical, and I'll have another one soon enough. And I remember when I was in high school, and I don't know if you remember Columbine, what happened in Colorado, and I remember an overwhelming feeling when I was young that could happen at my school. It was not the feeling of, oh, that something must be going on in the suburbs of Denver. And I went to Rockford. I almost said in Rockford. Rockford High School, yes, it's in Rockford. And that was the feeling. Oh, this could happen here. And that's a hard thing to want to be with as a young person. It's hard as a parent, you know. And it's hard to even know where to begin when to address something like this. I was even thinking about the history of C3. If I understand correctly, one of the reasons why Ian, former pastor, didn't want to continue to be in the United States was this exact reason. And what happened at Sandy Hook. I was a pastor at Mars Hill when Sandy Hook happened, and you know, one of the things that's challenging with a church or a spiritual community like we have is that it's a lovely challenge, and that is every week you have to stand up and say something, or somebody does. That's like hard, and it's not like you're in a band where you get to like play the same songs, you know, like. You just, oh, we're going to play, you know, Where the Streets Have No Name again, but this time in New York. And people are going to love it. You have to, like, come up with something new. And it sort of forces you into the conversation of what is happening right now in our culture. What's happening in our culture? By the way, songs can do that, too. Because songs they're played live somewhere. So maybe I shouldn't make such a separation. But in other words, I'm not just recycling some talk I gave recently. And that's part of the challenge of it. And so when things happen in our culture, it's hard to know whether or not you should say something about it or not directly. And I remember when Sandy Hook happened, my feeling was what's needed is a moment of silence and let's say something about this. I remember getting some critique from someone saying, if we turn our attention to every tragedy, we'll never get anything done. I thought, I thought, well, yeah, that's kind of true in a way. And also, that doesn't seem right. And yeah, so from time to time, I think it's important to try to ask what's happening. Now, Beth told me that 2 weeks ago when I taught, I asked like something like 32 questions or something. I wasn't aware that that's what I was doing, by the way, so that was a good mirroring. So today's probably going to be something like that. I'm going to ask some questions. And I would like to, before I get to the questions, say something like, we live in a symptom management culture. Symptom management. We think that symptom management or even symptom elimination is the same thing as healing. We think that symptom elimination is the same thing as wholeness. And we tend to fixate on various symptoms that we would like to address or alleviate. And there's a time and a place for symptom alleviation. Have you ever gone to see a therapist with and you have a specific problem? You would like some alleviation? Okay, yeah. But what's right beneath that, if you have a good therapist, what's right beneath that conversation is something like a trap door. And whether or not the symptom gets alleviated, the trap door just might open and you might enter the realm of what's really going on in your life. Do you know what I mean when I say that? Well, in a symptom alleviation culture, what would that look like? That would look like every single commercial on television trying to sell you a certain pill for a certain symptom. And if you could get that thing sorted out, you'd be whole or well or complete. Okay. When it comes to even some of the questions that I want to ask about how is it that we live in a world where young people shoot each other at school, I want to first try to acknowledge that fixating on one particular thing is probably not all that helpful. Like, how big of a magazine capacity should we sell in stores for guns? I'm also not saying that that's unimportant. Everything is important, we could say. But that's where the public conversation tends to go. Or if we just had more mental health professionals in the school system, we wouldn't have things like that. Look, you got to try something. You got to start the conversation somewhere. But I don't want to really ask those questions. I want to ask questions that are beneath the trap door of those given symptoms. Symptoms point to something. And I just want us to ask, what are they pointing to? What kinds of things are they pointing to? Or if you want to put it even lighter, what kinds of questions ought we to be asking? That's actually what I want to talk about today. What kinds of questions are worth asking? How many more years of this exact thing is going to take place? And it's a particularly American thing. How many more years? And you start to feel like numb. I thought of, in pre-talk, we were talking about some interesting things. And you should definitely come to the pre-talk gathering. Love to have you. And I remembered a Bob Dylan song called My Back Pages. It's one of the best songs. Here's the line. He says, I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. And the whole song is about the youthful desire to protest various things and take a stand and be certain about things. And he just sort of laments, I was so much older then. He's reversing like the elder young person image. He was saying, I was wise then, now I'm younger. And I don't know what to say. I'm interpreting the Dylan song a bit. I don't know what to say now. I knew what to say when I was 20, but I have no idea what to say now. And maybe that's just part of growing up, where we were forced into greater levels of complexity. But that can also lead to a kind of numbness, really. A kind of malaise or fog. And so I want to try to like blow a little wind into the fog if possible and at least say, what kinds of questions ought we to be asking? Let me say one other thing. Sometimes I hear about a tragedy like this, and for some reason, something like a timeline pops into my head, or a river. So one's a timeline, one's a river, but I'm using them in the same way. And I think to myself, and I wonder, what led up to this? Like, what was the timeline? I don't mean what happened that day or that week, but I mean the full timeline of a life. What kinds of things fed into, not in a fatalistic way, like a causal way, this plus this plus this. That's why I like the image of a river. Like, if you think about, if you ask the question, how many tributaries contribute to the Mississippi River? Like, what would you say? I mean, you could figure that out. You could probably Google it. But even that wouldn't be very helpful, because then you also have watersheds and mountains and... And wouldn't you say that all the tributaries matter? Maybe you wouldn't. I would say all the tributaries matter that feed into the thing that flows out called the Mississippi River into the Gulf of Mexico. Same with the timeline. How many interactions, conversations, grievances, pain, hurt, misunderstanding, longings, confusions fed into this tragic event that for some people will never go away. You might forget about it, I might forget about it, but for some people, never until they lie down on their deathbed. So that's why I wanted to begin with that reading about hope. Because what he is saying is hope is not about being optimistic about a situation, and it's not even about working for things that you think will work out. It's going about the business of trying to bring forth what is good in the world, regardless of the circumstances, and now to use my metaphor, trusting in something like no matter how small the tributary is or no matter what point in the timeline you intersect with someone or something, it changes the nature of the river itself. One text message changes the world. We know this from, remember that whole butterfly effect thing, you know? And we're like, oh yeah, we believe that. But we don't often really believe that. We don't often treat the world in that way, especially with big global problems. So, let me just ask some questions now. And Beth, you can keep count if you want. I'm sure I've already started. I don't even know it. I guess this is more of a statement. Madness is never far away. Madness is never far away. And it will never go away. Sometimes things go wrong. Illness of various kinds will never go away. We can't live with utopian ideas that just with the right education and the right language and the right laws, we can avoid all tragedies. We know that that's not the case. And in fact, I'm just saying it takes some courage to say human beings are complicated and there is darkness there. There's darkness. Let's not be naive about that. So here come the questions. What kind of society makes this possible? What kind of society makes this possible? In other words, the way we live, our lifestyle and value and values and what we think is important, what kind of society makes this possible? Because we can't say some other society made this possible. The one we live in. The one that we're contributing members to. Even if you're an anarchist and you don't pay your taxes, you're still a contributing member to the society with your anarchy. Here's another question. Is there an absence of love in our culture? Is there an absence of nurturing care in our culture? Is there a lot of disconnection or separation? And how do we get here? How do we get here? Here's another question. What's happening to family life? What's happening to family life? I'm not going to answer any of these in case you're wondering. I'm just saying these are things that begin to arise in me if I sit with it. Here's another question. What is the effect, and it's a little interpretive on my part, what is the effect of mass factory education? And I'm not just trying to sound like Pink Floyd. What's their song? We don't need no education. It's a factory model of education. If you watch Pink Floyd's The Wall, there's like a factory going on in there, like marching through. It is our model for education. It's not, I mean, as much as we'd like to say it's from the Greek Socratic mentor-mentee relationship, that's there sometimes. But we do have a factory model. Our buildings even look like mini factories. So I'm asking the question, what's the effect of that? And I'll finish it. What is the effect of mass factory education on the human soul? Or what's the effect of a factory approach to education on the individual? You have these five subjects, and you go through them regardless of how you're oriented or wired or your disposition or your family background, you get run through the same grid. What effect does it have? I'm not even saying it's wrong. I'm just saying what are the consequences down the line to the human soul and to the individual? Here's another question. What happens, especially to our young people, but you're probably feeling it now too, what happens when we feel anonymous? What happens to the human soul, the spirit, when you feel anonymous? How is it that we have allowed or created media that so easily fuels hatred? Somebody created it. Here's a related question. It's pretty much the same question as anonymous, but what happens to our young people? Now I'm thinking specifically of young people when they feel invisible. What happens when they feel invisible? I'll tell you what happens. Depression, self-harm, bullying, and suicide. All of them are on the rise, not shrinking. All of them. So I guess I kind of answered that question. But I'm not trying to give the final answer. I'm just saying, what happens to our young people when they feel invisible? Well, we medicate them instead of initiate them. Especially in a symptom alleviation culture. And I thought it was interesting that one of my heroes, Robert Bly, passed away this past week, 94. And Robert Blyde changed my life. I mean, he continues to change my life. Right now I'm in the middle. I just happen to be in the middle of an online 8-month course that I'm leading on his book called Iron John. It's a book about the masculine, which is related to some of what I'm hovering around here. And one of the things that Robert Bly, was doing, particularly in the 80s and 90s, was restarting the conversation of how do young men, in particular, grow up? And what he was saying is that there's not a human culture on the planet that hasn't acknowledged very directly and out loudly that young men do not grow up easily, that it's very challenging, and that much of the elder's job was to initiate young people, particularly young men. I mean, that's more the conversation that Robert Bly was having, that lots of other people are having conversations around the feminine. But Robert Bly was, for one reason or another, interested in that conversation. What's my point? It's not a given that a boy will become a contributing member of society and a man. It's not a given. And Robert Bly was saying every culture on the planet knows that. And we don't want to have that conversation anymore. And there's a great loss. So he's trying to restart the great conversation around initiation. How do young people grow up? And I also thought about Richard Rohr. So Richard Rohr, who I mentioned before, he's a Franciscan priest. He's also been very influential in my life. And I think he's the one that turned me on to Robert Bly, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know. I don't think it was the other way around, but he has a book called The Five Promises of Male Initiation. Five Promises of Male Initiation. Something like that. That might be the subtitle. Doesn't matter. I'm going to give you five. I'm just going to give you what he says. He says, this is what young men in particular need to learn in order to grow up. And by the way, hardly anybody's talking like this, really. So this is coming from the ancient world, in my view. It's coming from the deep river of memory in the underworld that I keep referring to. But just listen. Now, you can disagree, but this is what he says. Five things. Life is hard. That's like number one. Life is hard. Not easy. You're not entitled to things. He's saying we have to pass through. Part of the initiation is into the reality that life is hard. It's also part of the tenet number one in Buddhism. Life is suffering. Well, hard. Here's number two. He says, by the way, if you don't get these five, you're in real trouble. And who's in trouble? Not just the individual, but the culture, the society. Number two, you are not that important. You're not that important. He says, particularly in his view, particularly for young men, they need to experience this at a certain point. You're not that important. And here's the counter side of that, because that can sound quite mean. That's why generally initiators were not the parents in ancient culture. They came from outside the family or an uncle or something like that. Here's number three. Your life is not about you. Do you feel the tension between that? You're not that important. And also, life is not about you. So you have to then say, well, what is it about? Here's number four. You're not in control. You're not in control. And here's number five, my personal favorite. You're going to die. There's a kind of harshness in these five. He calls them promises. I don't know why he calls them promises. I think that softens. It doesn't sound like lessons or something. They're promises. The promise is if you can integrate these five things, you'll be a contributing member to society and someone on the way to becoming an elder, if you can live with these realities, that life is hard, that I'm not that important, that life isn't about me, that I'm ultimately not in control and I'm going to die. Yeah, so, okay, then how are we going to live? And I think if I come back to some of the questions I was trying to raise before about what kind of society allows for such a thing, what kinds of things are young people not hearing in a culture of anonymity and invisibility? Here's one other train of thought I want to just pick up on, and then I want to read this passage about hope again. Life, in my view, and contemporary life is growing more complex, not less. And I think part of the task, after I'm, this is in a series called Born for These Times, part of what we're born for these times to face is greater levels of complexity. We have to. We can't just think it's about one issue anymore. It's not. Even some of the issues we were talking about in pre-talk around education and abortion and all kinds of interesting things were coming up. As soon as we get into it, we realize we're wading into levels of complexity. And what I'm saying, I think, Leslie, you may have said this, we have to stand up to the levels of complexity and say, okay, let's engage on that level. And there's something about the like button that doesn't want to face complexity. So some of my friends helped start Art Prize. I'm a big fan of Art Prize. You should go to Grand Rapids whenever it's around if you haven't been there before. It's a good thing. Why is it a good thing? Because it helps restart a conversation around beauty and around art. It's important. I had one critique just before it became a thing. I was talking to a friend who was involved with this, and I said, do you really want to have essentially a like button when it comes to art? You like this or don't? That's going to be it? And he basically was like, it's better than nothing. I was like, okay, it's better than nothing. And this was early on, really. Art Prize has been around for a while. It was early on in social media where you heart things and like things. I mean, it was happening, but it was still pretty early on. But just think how much of the lens through which you consume your media is based on the like button at this point. Thumbs up. We don't even have the alternative. I guess we do. Is there a thumbs down button? Oh, people say there are. I should hit that more often. Okay. But that's it. And somebody says something, pontificates, and what's our response? That's not a conversation. And that, I think, as a cultural phenomenon, actually complicates the very questions that I'm trying to ask, even around this tragedy. What happens when we begin to view people and their ideological positions as either thumbs up or thumbs down? That's a very dehumanizing environment. All I'm saying is I think the social media landscape makes it more challenging, the way we engage these things. And Art Prize, actually, I'm not making fun of it, but sometimes when you see the top 10, you realize this is not a conversation about art at this point. Or it is, but it's, yeah. For a while, I was that, when I taught high school, I also managed the school newspaper. And we did a spoof one time that we called Tiny Prize. And that who could have the world's smallest piece of art, and that would be the winner. Because at the time, only big things won at Art Prize. So we had this little spoof on. And some people thought it was real. It's like, oh, that's really interesting then. Do Tiny Prize next year. It's like, they're not. So I want to encourage you in your own way, in all of the many tributaries that you get to be a part of that influence the timeline of someone's life. Those thousands of intersecting points with other human beings, I want to encourage you that they matter. All the little interactions matter, even with strangers. I don't often live like that. I treat the person who's like giving me my food at a restaurant as like, I don't know, a conveyor belt. You know, it's a human being. And these interactions matter, especially if we can get out of our minds that it's all about us and what we like and dislike. And I want to encourage you in your own way, as I can tell, and I learn from you each week, to enter these really hard conversations about what kind of culture we want to live in with a high degree of complexity. That's what's required right now, I think. The final question I want to ask, and it sounds very like hippie-ish. But then I just remembered that one of the Johns, the letters of John, says, God is love. And I was going to say, what would it look like for us to take some responsibility in being more loving in the world? Because I cannot look at something like this without saying there's an absence of love. There is. There's an absence of love. And you and I, can contribute, even if in a small way, to the tributaries of what's the right way of putting it? Now I lost my place. Love can be a tributary. That's my point. All right, I'm going to read this if I can find it. The thing about a bookmark is that when you take it out, it doesn't work anymore. That's not a question. Where the heck is this? It's going to be worth the wait. Hope is a state of mind. Hope is a state of mind. Not a state of the world. Either we have hope within us or we don't. It's a dimension of the soul. And it's not essentially dependent on some particular observation of the world or estimate of the situation. Hope, in this deep and powerful sense, is not the same as joy that things are going well, or a willingness to invest in enterprises that are obviously headed for early success, but rather an ability to work for something because it is good, not just because it stands a chance to succeed. The more unpropitious the situation in which we demonstrate hope, the deeper that hope is. Hope is definitely not the same thing as optimism. It is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense regardless of how it turns out. I hope you can find within you, within your own soul, that seed of hope that wants to live in the world in the way in which he's describing. Thanks for listening.